Well, I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News Dimitri Kapetis from EHDO Architecture. Welcome along.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what we're here particularly to talk about is sustainable housing, both in terms of money and design, location, all sorts of things, because there's a fabulous development in prospect under the Nightingale banner at the corner of Blinko and Wood Streets in Fremantle, and you, Dimitri, are absolutely mixed up in it. Tell us how this came about.
Well, I'm very mixed up in it, unfortunately. No, it's been a good process, but it started off before I'd even heard of Nightingale, and the block next to me came up for sale, and I'd always wanted to do medium density, mixed use developments that were really focusing on environmental issues. And this seemed like a great opportunity. It had the right zoning, and I live next door, so I really wanted to control what was there. Couldn't look at something hideous for the rest of my life. So that was the very first part of it. And then I started looking into the ideas that I wanted to achieve from the development, and somebody put me onto Nightingale, one of my friends in Melbourne who's an architect, and they said, have you seen Nightingale? And I looked through it, and it was just tick, 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 everything that I was trying to do. So
It started from there,
that's right.
Now, just before we go on, we've identified the area. I think we're on the southwestern corner, aren't we, of Blinko and Wood.
Right.
Now, just describe for people who don't know that area of Fremantle, just what sort of amenity or what description you would give to this area.
Yeah, it's a really interesting area because it's somewhere that's really close to a major centre like Fremantle, but it's got all of this vacant land that's been used for light industrial purposes. There's a big area where there was oil tanks that have now been removed, and the land has to be remediated. And a lot of this sort of light industry, like plumbers and, you know, furniture manufacturers and places like that. And that's all slowly sort of moving out. But I think the residents, I'm part of the residents committee as well, and we're really keen to retain as much of that as possible so that it doesn't lose that character of that industrial character. It's what's what makes it sort of different. But then also injecting a whole bunch of people into there as residents so the area becomes more vibrant and mixed use and multi-residential sort of medium density is what we're trying to create there. And Fremantle Council's totally behind it and really supportive, which has been great for us.
Now, to start this conversation off a little more, people listening to this interview will be also able to look at the images of the development that you have approval for. And here's one that shows you the sort of the front facade from what, Blinko Street?
Yeah, that's the corner of Blinko and Wood, but yeah, mainly from Blinko Street looking back towards the south.
So talking about, by the look of it, three levels plus a rooftop area and sort of two sections to the development, stepping back from Blinko Street but with a frontage to Wood. How does that work?
So the idea behind splitting the building like that was we wanted every single apartment to get north light in winter. So in order to do that, we needed to break the mass of the building to allow north light to penetrate into the back of the site. But it also helped us get cross ventilation through the middle of the site as well. You know, we're lucky in Fremantle, everyone knows about the Doctor, which, you know, just really will channel through that area. And then if we open up, all apartments can be opened both sides so that you can get that cross ventilation through. Yeah, I mean, that's the main reason for splitting it. But we've got, across this front here, we've got all one-storey apartments so that we can have universal access for those. And then on the rooftop, you can see there's a huge gardened area, which is over 400 square metres, which has got shared laundries and storage and productive garden areas for everyone to grow their veggies and stuff like that, and a big social area with a kitchen and things like that. So it's really to try to promote everyone coming together as a community and give them a space to do that.
One thing I've always wondered about are the sort of the European allotments where people live in small urban habitats and go off to their allotments to grow their vegetables and so on. Do we have any capacity for that on this site?
Yeah, well, the allotment is that roof terrace. It's got a lot of space for growing things. We've got areas for fruit trees and areas for sort of leafy things, and then things that can handle a little bit more sun. We've tried to really do that with the design so that we've got a variety of spaces and conditions up there. It will get pretty salty wind, so, you know, it'll be those Fremantle veggies that have to survive up there. But, yeah, I've always found it really interesting. I've got a lot of family in Europe, and there's this misconception in Australia that apartments aren't great places for kids to grow up. And when I looked at my family growing up in Athens and places like that, and all these kids are in apartments, and then there'd be a little mall in front where cars couldn't go, and it would be full of all the kids in the neighbourhood playing down there, and there's everyone to look after each other and watch each other, and there's this really amazing community going on. And I think that's why I'm trying to show and trying to provide a space that highlights that apartments are actually really great places to live with kids if you've got the right amenity and aspect and things like that.
Now, we're going to come back to the more, if you like, theoretical concepts which underpin a development like this. But whilst we're talking about the practicalities of the design, there's another image here which looks like, well, not just a courtyard in a typical sense, but with a beautiful, looks like silver birch tree or something in the middle of it. Yep. This is what, the centre of that first section of the development, is it?
Yeah, so that's that split that I was mentioning before, where we've split the building into two pieces, and we've got all the walkways and the access to the apartments through this garden space. I think I was mentioning to you off air that it's one of those things in apartment buildings that I hate, and I know a lot of people hate, is going down some nasty dark corridor to get to your apartment. And we wanted to make that access way something enjoyable to use every day, but also useful. So there's some spaces in there that you can go and hang out and really appreciate that cool breeze in summer without being hammered by the sun in this internal space. And this image here that we're looking at, it shows what we're trying to do on the ground floor, which is be really inclusive to the community and make that ground floor something that everybody feels invited and can actually come and use from the surrounding community. So it's not this sort of exclusive development thing where you've got, you know, your big gate and your swipe cards. There is privacy and there is security from the car park area to the lift, but the rest of the ground floor, we really want it to be very transparent to look through. So there's a lot of glass. But also, you know, really inviting, so people feel like they can come in and use these spaces to hang out and have their coffees and whatever they want to do.
As you look at that image, assuming the final development mirrors it, you've got sliding doors into rooms on the left and the right. Are they ground floor apartments?
No ground floor apartments. We've got all the apartments upstairs. So all the ground floor is going to be commercial shared use for the community.
Yes. Yeah. Now, we've started to get into aspects of the development features. You've already mentioned that that laundries and the like would be communal. How does that work?
Yeah, the laundry is a funny one. People sort of can get a little bit scared by the communal laundry thing. They sort of think they're going back to the 40s or something like that. But what they've found, the Nightingale developments in Melbourne, is that you take the laundry out of an apartment, that's adding to your apartment probably, you know, 10 square meters, 8 square meters of space that you use once a week, pretty much. And by putting it all up on the roof, you can add all that space back into your apartment, say your living room, which is probably more useful. And then what they found in Melbourne is that it's something strange about doing this banal daily jobs together, where you just run into each other and you don't have to sort of meet up for a coffee or anything. You might just be, you know, washing your undies or something next to somebody who you live with. It really creates a bonding community feeling. And, you know, it's something that I think is really important in this day and age as we sort of retreat further and further into our digital social worlds.
It's a meeting place.
It's a meeting place. It's the water cooler of the residential water cooler.
Well, every time I've been into a laundromat, which is usually when I've been travelling, that's exactly the experience. You pick up some local knowledge and get some good tips, where to eat, what movies are on.
I don't know what it is.
Now, this is an appropriate stage in this discussion to talk about the Nightingale concept. This is badged under that, and as I would understand it, you've in a broad sense, got the license to use this concept. But tell us about Nightingale. Just where did it come from? What's it about? And are there other housing concepts like it around the globe?
Okay. Nightingale, it started in Melbourne with a group of architects, or one in particular, Jeremy McLeod from Breathe. And it was a response to what he saw as the really poor quality apartment buildings getting put up all around Melbourne. And realising that the reason for that was that they were totally, all the decision making in terms of the architecture was based on investment and investors' needs. Now, the whole point of that is that an investor doesn't really care that much about how the building performs or how enjoyable it is to live in after they sell it. So once they've got their money, next development and move on. I'm not saying that all developers are evil by any means, but really that's their motive. And what he wanted to do was take a lot of that decision-making power and put it back into the hands of the people who are going to live in it. So that's where it started from. And then it was obviously developed on more and more. So they talk about the four-leaf clover of Nightingale, where we've got affordability, environmental responsibility, social responsibility, and community inclusion. So they're the four things that are really important to Nightingale. And you really, when you're doing a Nightingale project, you need to be able to hit all those targets and show that you're addressing all of those things.
Well, take the first one. How does that work?
Affordability. So the price of the apartments is not related to the market. It's related to the cost of the production. So it's really a matter of how much does it cost to buy the land, how much does it cost to pay all your consultants, and then how much does it cost to build it. And the apartments really relate to that, not to the market. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect is looking at long-term affordability, so building into the building and the design features that allow your living costs to be lower over a long period of time. Those things are obviously performance, environmental performance, how much it costs to heat and cool your house. But there's also aspects like owning the one of the commercial spaces on the ground floor by the tenants and using the rental income of that to offset some of your costs, ongoing living costs like strata fees and things like that. That's the main affordability sort of in a nutshell. And then we environmental things we've talked about.
Tell us about that. You've touched on it, but how do they stack up?
Really it's about making decisions based on getting the apartments to perform the best way that they can, but also things like landfill and looking at long-term environmental impacts. So the cost of the production of the material, the performance of the material, and then the end result once that material goes back into the earth and is either a toxic material or something which can be, accepted by the planet a little bit more.
So does the Nightingale footprint, if you like, bring with it a whole lot of development standards in terms of materials?
Yeah, I don't think there's not a rule at the moment, like a list of yes and no can't users, but what we're really talking about with Nightingale Projects is that every building should be better than the last one. So all of the information passed on should be passed on by the architects who've done ones in previous Nightingale projects. So that includes things like informing about materials and what to use, how to use it and things like that.
So give us on both the affordability questions of keeping the longer term costs of running your apartment down as well as these environmental factors of design. Give us some indicators again about how this works. You've talked about lighting and making sure everything has northern features to it. That has the obvious advantage of cutting down during the winter, in particular, your heating costs. In terms of cooling, you've talked about the fact that you've got flow through
cross ventilation
in every one of the units, so that the Fremantle doctor can do its work during the summer. But what about the supply of energy, electricity to these apartments? How does that work?
Well, we've got a huge PV array up on the roof, so we're looking at 50 kilowatts or something like that as a minimum, and that will be over the top of the productive or the gardens on the roof and on the back roof as well. So that will be something which is shared by all of the residents. We haven't worked out the final setup at the moment, but more than likely it's going to be something like all of the energy will go into a central point and then be distributed to the apartments, and there'll be a ledger about how much everyone's used, and the owners can come together and decide whether they want to have free power or if they want to pay a little bit for power, and that money again will go back to the paying all the strata fees and things like that.
Okay. Now, what about other features when it comes to the actual design of the apartments or the fixtures and fittings and the like? What, if not unique, are different and part of the sustainability concept?
I think our walls are something that doesn't get used much, is the reverse brick veneer here in Perth. We found that in terms of affordability and performance, it's pretty hard to beat it because we've got all of our insulation on the outside leaf. So we're maintaining a pretty solid temperature, and then the internal leaf is the thermal mass, which is, you know, doesn't change its state very quickly. So you're protecting that, so it stays very very solid in winter and summer. Then we've got things like fittings and fixtures, like you mentioned, which there's some stipulations from Nightingale about using the right materials, and chrome is one of the ones which sort of jumped out at me that I hadn't realised until I started doing this. Project.
What is it about chrome? What are you talking about here?
It's a very toxic material that once finished with and put back into the earth has, you know, great toxicity, and something that, you know, try not to use wherever we can. So we've used brass fittings everywhere, pretty much, handles.
And, we're talking about taps and handles on things and door handles, right?
Yep, all these kinds of things. The lighting is all, you know, low energy lighting. And yeah, apart from that, it's about using as little material as we can as well. It's that wastage factor, being able to build something that doesn't have a whole bunch of waste that just goes into landfill, which most buildings do, and about not layering a building too much, so that you use the materials, you see the materials that are making the building, rather than having to layer things and cover things and that kind of thing.
In terms of when people go in and look at a house or an apartment, the layout and what you've tried to achieve, you mentioned many of them are one-bedroom and two-bedroom apartments, and we're looking at another image over here. What are we looking at in that image? Is that a...
That's a two-bedroom apartment, and what we're looking at is we're trying to really show in this image how much north light you're going to get. And you can see in this apartment, which are the top-storey two front apartments, we've got the full face, which is 8 metres wide, 8.7 metres wide, all north-facing. So it'll just be flooded with winter light. And then the eaves are dimensioned so that we don't get any sun into the apartment from the middle of winter. Sorry, what was that? The middle of spring to the middle of autumn. So it's that swing season. We'll try to hit that point where the sun starts to get a bit hot and heat up your house, and then it's not inside. So he'll hit that door frame. That's what it's all been worked around. The other thing that this image, I think, is trying to get across is the connection of garden and landscape to the building, to the apartments. And I think that's one of the hardest things about living in an apartment is not having that direct connection to a garden. So what we've tried to do with the design is make sure that wherever you're at in your apartment, you have visual access to greenery. And a real feeling of gardens in the apartments, rather than just being, you know, a couple of pots on the balcony. It's about creating spots where we've got climbing vines and trees growing up from lower levels to make canopies that you look out at, things like that.
Okay. Now, just at a few practical levels, you mentioned about a car park earlier. If people buy into the project, there's sort of no antithesis when it comes to motor vehicles. You can have a car and you can park it there.
It's one of the other things about in the Nightingale projects in Melbourne had no car parking, but we all know the public transport infrastructure in Melbourne is slightly better than in Perth, and we just have a different culture of car use over here. So we've limited the car bays to one per unit. And
as you look at this big image here of the facade off Blenko Street, there's a car, actually, a huge car.
It must be
a real estate agent's car parked in a driveway. Where does that take you?
So this one takes you into the car park here. We've put the car park on that western side of the building. Like I said, we've got one bay per unit, and we've got a couple of spots for share cars as well. So what we found, that there's not really a share car company that's operating in Perth right now. There's, you know, lots in the eastern states, but we think that you could have a couple of shared cars just for this community, or shared by whoever you want. You've got an app for it, and everyone can just hire the car and use it as they need to.
Now, coming back to the affordability aspects and the sustainable notions involved in that, you've touched upon how these apartments would be priced, but explain that in more detail. You add up all the costs of constructing the development we're looking at,
yep.
And let's say it costs X million dollars. There's a formula, is there, as to what they then get marketed for?
It really is just a result of that cost, and you work backwards from that. But that's our job, to design it so that they're not market rate or above. We try to get everything under market rate, which we think we've done for these kind of apartments. And do you want me to talk you through the sort of setup of the company?
Tell us about that. So you were talking earlier about how in a classic apartment development, investors will be attracted, they'll get a certain return on investment,
yep.
And if they like what they've done and they work well with the developer, they'll look at the next project and on they go. People who come into this development are going to be attracted to its particular features. Can they be investors as well, or are they a separate group? And are there restrictions on if you buy in at a certain price, can you only sell at a certain price? Take us through all of that.
Okay, sure. What we do, you mentioned before, I'll sort of go back a little bit. You mentioned before about other models that are similar,
yes,
to this. And one of the other great models around is Baugruppe, which is used really commonly in Europe, particularly in Germany, as you could tell by the name. And it's very similar in that a whole bunch of people get together, find a site, employ architect and consultants to do the job, and then they don't pay stamp duty and things like that when they have their apartment, because they bought it as a group. And that's fantastic, but you need a little bit more money up front. So what Nightingale tries to do is raise the money needed for buying the site and getting to construction finance by asking investors to come into the project who are silent and don't get a say in any of the decisions. And they put in their money at a fixed return. So they'll only get a maximum of 12% on their return, but there's no guarantee for under 12%. So, that's up to us to make that work as well. So they come in, put all the money in for their return, and then people who are buying the apartments are a different group. Now, you can be an investor and an apartment owner, but they're a separate group, and a lot of the time that gets confused.
So the investors have put up the money. They're expecting no more than 12.5% return on capital. The development is carried out. It's marketed, and then people come in, and under all of that sort of sustainable financing plan, they know they're not, in that sense, being exploited by an over market price. So you buy in, and let's just say, for argument's sake, I don't know, pick a figure, $500,000, you finish up with an apartment, and in 3 years' time, you might be getting older, or you might want to move to Margaret River or something.
Change circumstances,
you want to sell. What happens then? Are there rules?
There is rules. Because we're making these apartments hopefully under market value, and we don't want investors, we want owner-occupiers as a most part, because of the community aspects. So there is a covenant on resale. So you can only sell your apartment for what you paid for it, plus any rise in the housing index in your area. So if there's an upsurge in, you know, Fremantle goes nuts. So you get that upsurge, but you can't profit off the savings that you made from the beginning. You have to pass that profit on to the next owner. So you don't lose any money in terms of what profit you make on your apartment, but you just can't, what's the word, really just cash in on the system and get your, ethically financed apartment and then flip it and make the profit yourself straight away.
So just coming back to that and understanding it, if one bought the unit at 500 and it were possible to sell it for a 100% markup, because Fremantle had gone nuts, as you put it, so it could sell for $1 million. You wouldn't get to take the 500 $100,000 capital gain.
That's right, yeah. You'd be only be able to take, say it went up by 10% in Fremantle.
Yes.
You'd get that 10%. You'd be able to sell your apartment for that increase of 10%, but you can't take that 10% plus the money that you saved on being below market value at the beginning.
So does that mean that the apartment can only be sold for a ceiling price, or does it get sold for a higher price and some funds go back into the development?
No, there's a ceiling price, yeah. It's related to what you paid for it, plus the housing index which you can get from the government, yes, and apply that to the amount you paid.
So the result of that is, and this is where we get to the other couple of points of the four that you mentioned, that down the track, when somebody's selling, there'll be a ceiling on the price for which it's being sold, and people out in the market will, in most probability, be able to buy into this development over the years because the prices will be more affordable.
That's the idea, yeah. So that affordability gets passed on from owner to owner. It's not just the one person gains from it.
Yes. Now, take us to those other two factors. I think you talked about social factors.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to get on my soapbox too much at this point. But there's one example that I've used a few times when talking about this. And I went to this lecture from a Syrian architect last year or 2 years ago at UWA, and she was talking about the way that architecture changed in her country and the effect that had on the society, and these that actually had a real effect in producing the conditions that were required to have a civil war. And of course, that's a super extreme example, but we do see in our society at the moment, particularly politically, that people are becoming more and more divided and less accepting of each other. We have less contact in everyday life. We sort of live on our phones and our digital media, which is all fine, but it's a lot easier to hate someone you've never talked to. So diversity is really important to us, and having people who from a surrounding community can come into your apartment, your development on the ground floor, and use the development, and it just creates a society that people are working together, have to actually make decisions, sometimes uncomfortable ones together, about, you know, what crop you're going to plant on the roof garden or whatever might happen to be. But, it's about, you know, creating small-scale communities that link with other small-scale communities in the surrounding suburb, and being, really inclusive and politically diverse as much as we can.
Now, I've promptly forgotten the last of the four factors.
Oh, yeah, there was social and then there was community. So those two are obviously pretty
interlinked. They run together, really.
Yeah, yes. I often talk about them together. But I think the difference is the social aspect is about about the people within that community and creating a good social interaction between all the residents and the people on the ground floor. And the community is about how this project sits in its environment and in its location, how it attracts people and includes people from the surrounding suburb, and that it's not an island. It's in its own context, and people need to, when they're doing developments, see that this isn't something that can just be placed anywhere. It needs to react to a specific environment that it's in.
Now, we have a couple of other images here that we'll be able to look at when people listen to the interview. This is obviously a smaller shot inside an apartment, as it would be. What is this showing?
So this is one of the apartments on the north face, looking into the courtyard space from the back bedroom. So really what this image is trying to show is that, you know, all the bedrooms are going to have these, you know, beautiful views into garden spaces and things like that, while maintaining privacy with the screens behind, so people can't look into your bedroom. You can control that. And also really using very honest, basic materials. So all we're using here is rendered brickwork, very lightly rendered, painted brickwork, and not too many materials, very simple. And I think on the other one there, you can see the concrete ceiling as well, with all the lighting running from that.
Well, that, going back to the question of materials and sustainability, you occasionally see large apartment developments. They might be five or six levels in height, And they have to be repainted every now and then, or there are other upkeep responsibilities. What are the features of this development?
Well, one of the features, most striking one that I'm looking at right now, is we've used white metal, which isn't the most environmentally sustainable to produce, but in terms of maintenance and longevity, it's fantastic. So we haven't used a dark or a coloured metal because that will fade and look sad within, you know, 5 years or something. You see a lot of black metal buildings going up around at the moment, and I sort of look at those and go, God, they're just a heat sink, because they, you know, obviously dark, you know, sucks in the heat. So this will be really reflective, and it won't fade and look sad after a few years. So that's an obvious one.
Now, in terms of the design, you sometimes hear architects waxing lyrical about what they were doing and how it reflects the maritime nature of the coastline or something, or other, a little bit like a poet explaining what the poem was about. But none of that's meant to be pejorative. But what's driving the design here, apart from the obvious questions of the allotment that it's on and the immediate neighbourhood, which may explain it all? But what are you doing here?
Well, in materials, we're trying to, you know, reflect the area that it's in terms of being a light industrial area. So we've used metal and brickwork, which is very common in this area. But apart from that, we're not sort of trying to mimic any style in particular. What you're looking at, it really is a result of performance in terms of psychology and in terms of heating and cooling and, you know, all of the environmental things we talked about. So we've worked backwards from what we need from the apartments, and the form really does follow that function in this case.
Now, I think there's about 15 apartments up. That's obviously driven by the size of the allotment you've got to work with. And when you, Nightingale in concept, do something like this, do they have a particular demographic in mind? Are we looking at single university students? Are we looking at elderly married couples? Are we looking at a nuclear family? What are we talking about here?
I think what we want is diversity as much as we can. So I'd love a few university students if they can afford to get into the housing market. And, you know, I'd love some families, but as I was talking about before, trying to show that apartment living doesn't have to be just for singles or retirees. People who, you know, there's this feeling like, oh, yeah, I'll get an apartment, live there until I can afford to move to the suburbs. And, you know, that's not what we want. We want, these are long-term places, and we don't want people just spreading out and out and out into the suburbs in Perth. We want to have medium density, not high-rise. That's the other problem that I find in a lot of places, particularly in Perth, is they say, oh, it's either one story or two story, or it's 15 stories, like, you know, you see through South Perth and stuff like that. And when you're talking about creating community and things like that, 15 stories is not going to do it. You don't know everybody in that apartment building. You don't have connection to them. You only might have connection to the people who get off the lift at the same place that you do. And that's why we think this scale development is appropriate. 15 to, say, 25 apartments is a good balance of how many people to, before you start to lose touch with everybody and don't really have a strong community.
Well, Dimitri, it really sounds and looks from these images like a fantastic development. The scale looks fabulous. The design is unobtrusive, in fact, very inviting. The use of vegetation and the design features you've described. Around when would you hope to have this opening and people living in it?
The aim is by the end of next year. So either, you know, December 2019 or the beginning of the next year.
Yes. Well, look, the very best of luck with getting it to happen. It's really exciting to see this concept working, and we certainly hope that it does and it takes off and that it gives rise to people either copying it or doing Nightingale all over again.
That's right, lots more.
And we'll give the reference to your website where people can go and see it all and indeed contact you to talk about getting into it.
Yeah, that's right. I'm more than happy to talk to people about it. It's something that I really want to promote. And so if anyone has any interest, please, you know, get in touch.
Well, thanks very much for talking to us, and good luck.
Thanks for having me.